I'm Vikram Mamri, and I run the program management team for Windows Azure. And my role is essentially multifold. And it basically includes taking the features and the feedback from the customers, such as CDP customers and the enterprise customers, taking that feedback, converting those into features, and then converting those features back into, like, you know, deliverables that get out to the production environment, right? And we've been doing this for the last 2 years, and our cycle is very iterative. We actually, like, you know, the good and the bad of running services in the cloud is you get the feedback immediately, right? You from the developer desktop, you build the service, deploy the service, and we push it to the cloud, and immediately we know the reaction, whether everything is going to stick or not, right? And it puts, you get the good feedback, but it also puts lots of pressure on you, because now you have to, like, you know, immediately rectify if there's a situation or if there's an issue in the cloud. But it gives us, like, you know, lots of flexibility to move bits to the cloud very quickly, get feedback from the customers, and then turn that around and build new features for the platform. And that's what my focus has been for the last 2 years. I love every bit of it. Coming to work every day and feeling excited that, like, you know, I'm going to make a change, I'm going to make an impact on the customers, and I'll be able to see my impact every single day basis. That's all.
Hi, I'm Sumit Mehrotra. I'm a program manager on the Windows Azure Developer Experience team. And let's see if I can give you a two-minute rundown on what is developer experience for Windows Azure. So as you know, Windows Azure is sort of the OS for the cloud. Just like Windows 7 is the OS for the client, we have Windows Azure as the platform for the cloud. What it means is it gives you resources to run your applications in the cloud. And since it's a platform, it's obvious that there's a lot of emphasis on developers and the experience that developers have trying to write these applications. So we put out a bunch of different components that can be used by developers to get started, from getting started onto the platform, to building their applications, to deploying their applications on Windows Azure. So let me give you a brief rundown on the three basic things that we have for developers. The first one is the SDK. Plus the Visual Studio tools associated with it, which provide you with not only the tools, the simulation tools for the cloud on your desktop, but provide you the client-side libraries, which consist of runtime libraries, storage client libraries, diagnostic libraries that enable you to do a lot of things during runtime. And they provide you the samples that let you get started on writing Windows Azure applications. Along with it, we also lay a lot of emphasis on the experience that developers already are used to in their familiar Visual Studio environment. So we have a tight integration of the Visual Studio environment with the SDK, so that when you go into Visual Studio, create a new project for Windows Azure, everything is there set up for you. All you have to do is create a new solution for cloud services, choose your favorite language to write your service in, and boom, you go there. You have the same F5 experience, you have the same debugging experience, and all the simulation tools are already integrated in there. So once you have your application running on the desktop, it's really easy to execute it, to debug it, to tweak it before you actually take it to the cloud. So that's the SDK in short. The other component is the service management APIs. And this is a set of APIs that are provided from the cloud. These are a set of REST APIs that you can talk to do your service management, which includes deploying your application, updating your application configuration, or upgrading your application to a new version of your service. So these are open REST APIs. You can build any sort of tools or any sort of dashboards on these APIs. For your users or for your application as you see fit. What we have done is we have provided a third aspect of for developer experience, which is the development portal, which is built on top of these management APIs. And this is the place where you go to sign up for Windows Azure accounts, subscribe to it, and then set up your account in such a way that you could either deploy your application through these APIs in an automated way, or you could do it in a UI-based way in this developer portal by uploading your package and configuration through a very friendly UI. So these three things in composition combine and give us the aggregated developer experience for people developing Windows Azure applications, right from writing the application, debugging it, making sure it's ready for deployment, to actually deploying and managing it, and seeing the status of it, and sort of signing for certificates and so on and so forth.
So you want to talk about Fabric Controller, Windows Azure. Windows Azure key promise is doing this automated service management, bringing the multi-tenancy at scale, basically a scale-out solution. And the way we actually get that done through the core of Windows Azure is the Fabric Controller. We actually do the management of the services, deployment. We have all these allocation in our data centers of the resources, and we get the information about the services, what they need. We map their needs, what we have, and do the allocation, service allocation. And then we actually manage it throughout the life cycle. If they want to increase, base scale out, we'll scale it out. If they want to shrink, when the load is low, we'll do that. And also Fabric Controller manages the health. If hardware goes bad, nodes need to be repaired, Fabric Controller does it without really impacting the service and actually run that through your service up all the time. We try to do that with high availability in mind, reliability, availability all the time in a performant way. And that's primarily what we do, service management, and with exposing all the mechanisms so it's easier for the developers, as well as managing resources in the data center throughout the lifecycle of the services.
So I'm Todd Holmquist-Sutherland. I'm the GPM for the .NET Services, which has now been renamed the App Fabric, Access Control, and Service Bus. And the Service Bus, in a nutshell, is a way to take applications that might be located in various different data center or networking environments and to connect them up in such a way that they can talk to one another without the developer, you as a developer, having to worry about the network configuration itself. So it allows you to seamlessly connect up applications, and it also gives you the ability to post or to publish those services in a way that's discoverable in a public namespace. You can actually control access to that namespace so that you can make it broadly discoverable by the public, or you can limit the kind of access that people have to discover your services. Another thing that we offer is something called the Access Control Service, also part of the new App Fabric, which is going to be within Windows Azure as well as running on Windows Server. The Access Control Service lets you lock down or control access to those publicly available endpoints that I was just talking about on the service bus. You could also use the Access Control Service to limit access to any sort of web service, a REST-based web service that you might have built, or applications that you've written that make use of web services can identify themselves to those web services using the Access Control Service. And it just provides a seamless, very easy-to-use way to ship an identity out to a web service and be identified uniquely by that web service so that you can then be have access control applied. So in a nutshell, those are the Access Control Service and the Service Bus, part of the Windows Azure Platform App Fabric.
So today we launched the Microsoft Dallas project, which is basically a global marketplace for any type of data, any type of information for developers and information workers. Effectively, your one-stop location to come in and find everything from structured data, blob data, real-time web services, whether it's for consumer applications or business applications and available on any platform.
So I'm Christian Dinsberger, and I am PM on Dallas. Thank you. And what's Dallas? Dallas is like a services in the cloud. They give you like, if you like, for example, you want to build like an application that does like find restaurants around you or like find crime data and whatever, you can like build an application, get all the data from us now, and use that in your application, mesh it up, and create your own little like view on it. And that's probably what Dallas is like in a nutshell. I know. So for example, it's one application that we built on top of Dallas and the NASA data that we got. And what it does is actually it allows you to search for certain like images from the rover missions, and then you can like just browse through them, and like we put a nice UI on top of our services here, and it gives it like images, and it gives us like structured data, like blob data and structured data, and yeah, like some information that you can like click the button and will actually like pan. Like these are like 3D images that we showed at the keynote. So this is like it. Building this like took us like a day or something or less, like a few hours, because the thing was like we just use our services. They return like an atom pub, and they're like simple REST queries. Like create a URL, like invoke it, get like an atom back, and then like stick it into a nice UI, and you're done, right? And it's a standardized format, so it's like really easy to do.
All right, welcome to the Microsoft Azure container here at the PDC. This particular container here is what something we call an IT pad, an IT preassembled component. And the key to the system is the adiabatic cooler system and the fans. And it takes a very limited amount of water. The average container today in our data centers for Microsoft take about 280 gallons a minute per water. They're chilled water. It takes an entire infrastructure. And if you take a look at this over here, pardon me, what we require to cool this unit at certain times, mind you, it doesn't require 24/7 water. It's a garden hose at room temperature. Okay, and I'll explain quickly how this all works. So you see, we have a temperature and humidity sensor, this giant little blue knob up here, which is fantastic. So we keep track of the temperature and humidity outside, because the ultimate goal is to make sure that the face of the servers, which you see inside of here, stays within a specific temperature and humidity range. Okay, so this entire system that's wrapped around these servers is designed to keep the inlet server temperature between 50 and 95 degrees Fahrenheit and 20 and 80% relative humidity. So how we do that is a couple of ways. First of all, what you see here are these filters that we change depending on the global conditions outside. Whether if you're in Bangkok and there's smog, or if you're in Dubai and there's sand, you can basically change these out. It's very inexpensive. Again, the whole unit is very inexpensive. So you see here we have motors that control the louvers on the outside, and hopefully we'll get a chance to see those in a second. So we control the louvers on the outside. There's actually three louver systems that are really key to the unit. And they're all controlled through this control unit that's sitting up here. So we have a control unit that controls the three louvers. And it's a negative air pressure system. So what happens is you have some fans in the back. They're specifically selected for this unit. A lot of research went into selecting the right types of fans, low energy. This entire system here, when we get done talking about it, it has a PUE of about 1.06. Right, so very low, and that's the relative usage of power for the entire unit versus how much compute power that we use. So what you have in here is an adiabatic cooler system. The Egyptians invented it, the Romans improved it. It's a very simple thing. It's just no different than it's a fiberglass filament, and we can take them in and out. And you have pipe up here that actually is run by some solenoids in here that's run by the control system that takes that room temperature water and actually sprinkles it over the top of this fiberglass filament. And what that does in two conditions, again, it doesn't need to be run 24 hours a day, it allows you to do two things. One, you can actually increase humidity, and you can also decrease the temperature within the unit. Right. So this particular unit was tested and proven that we could be deployed in a number of global, just about anywhere on the globe. We were tested and proved out Singapore, Dubai, and then various United States conditions that we're able to test it in. And this is version one of version. We're on about version 4 right now, so we've solved a lot of problems that this unit actually couldn't. And one of the things this particular unit had a little trouble with was really extreme cold temperatures, right? So we've solved that since then. But in case you have any questions about extreme cold temperatures, I'll be more than happy to be open and honest about it. So you have these three louver systems, one on the outside, one on each side of the adiabatic cooler. And so I'll just quickly explain it. You have the servers in here, and these servers are CE and ETL, UL 1995 listed. This entire unit is not a container, actually. It's classified as an air handling unit. All right, those air handling units that are on top of all the buildings you see when you're flying down into the airport, those big boxes that control airflow for the buildings, we basically took that technology and put servers inside of it. Bluntly, that's exactly what we did. Some engineering and architecture around how to make it maintainable, etc. So you have the servers, and these servers are classified as heaters. And so what you have is you have the heaters that currently, when the system's running and the outside air temperature doesn't require it to be warmer than in front of the servers here, excuse me. You see, we have some sensors in here. We have some temperature and humidity sensors. I apologize, get out of the way here. And so these keep track. These are kind of big, so we've made them a little bit big so you guys can see and we can talk about them. These units here, so they make sure that they're telling the control system what the temperature and humidity is in front of the servers. You've got the outside ones telling us what it's outside. So when the temperature decreases, they take that warm air that's being pulled through the servers, right, and the hot air, which is about 125 degrees, I think, right around there, and when necessary, the fans will actually open the louvers in the front. And what that'll do is it'll pull the hot air back around in front, so you're actually using the server's heat itself to keep the servers at a certain temperature. Right? It's a pretty simple idea. Took us a while to figure it out. So the two louvers are here in front and back of the adiabatic cooler, so we can either take that hot air, mix it with the incoming air. So there's a lot of complex research around trying to figure out exactly how open the louver should be versus the louver systems. That took a long time to figure out. But once we figure that out, you take a certain amount of outside air, or you shut them completely in a really cold environment, and you allow the warm air to come around to the backside of the adiabatic cooler if you want to increase humidity. Right? That's what you use the cooler for. If you don't, you want to bring it on the front. When you walk through here, you see there's a louver in the front. We just use warm air and blow that in front of here. So we're always constantly opening and shutting louvers and spinning up and spinning down the fan. We can do it from anywhere on the planet. The control system that's actually over there on the desk, you can take a look at it. It's kind of neat if you actually have someone explain it to you. There's a gentleman here that can do that. So what it comes down to is you've got servers that are just a rack of servers. This particular unit was a proof of concept. It's 9 racks, 45U, 405U. Right now we have servers in here. We have roughly, I think, about 860 servers in this little box. And that's motherboards, not virtuals and nothing like that. So you'll see there's servers in here. Each one of these servers have about 2 to 4 motherboards apiece. And that's pretty much the explanation of the entire unit.
So SQL Azure is database as a service. It's Microsoft taking SQL Server, the technology that we've built on premises, and hosting it in our data centers, on our machines, in our cloud, and providing that service to you as a customer that you can then pay for as you use. We bring the familiar relational T-SQL model, as well as the APIs and tools and the entire ecosystem they're familiar with SQL, combined with very simple provisioning and high availability to make it easy to manage and take care of your services while still having the familiar and valuable programming model that you've grown to know and love over the years with SQL Server.
Identity Foundation is a framework that is designed to support the Federation model. The Federation model is easily described, given kind of a sample scenario that I'll depict up here. So imagine that you have an application within a single domain. You've got Active Directory deployed. You have Windows clients that can interact with this app and be authenticated using, for example, Kerberos or NTLM. There's no login information that you typically need to supply in this information. It's all behind the scenes using symmetric key technologies. Now imagine that you want to take this app or this client and move them into a separate security domain. So let's say we're going to move them outside of, in my case, Microsoft, okay, over to, let's say, IBM. So we have this app that we've built, and we're going to try and give IBM users the ability to interact with our app. Okay, so the client then exists over there. Now, in this situation, there is no centralized directory that we have in Microsoft for knowing about IBM employees and what their attributes are and what groups they're a part of. So we have no real security information. So what the Windows Identity Foundation does is that we develop the protocols like WS Trust or WS Federation. We've built the foundation of the servers for trust management. Servers being called STS, Security Token Services. Okay? And technology that you can put out in front of an app for consuming authentication information in this scenario. So since the way that it works is that since we don't have any directory information, we establish points of trust within each domain. Those two parties or entities trust each other, usually a certificate exchange is involved in that. And there's some contractual agreement about the characteristics of the user that will be authorized or authenticated when they interact with the app. So the way that it works is that the client goes and tries to hit the application, they're rejected, they're given a challenge, if you will. They get redirected back to their STS, where they can go and get a token. Their STS might be associated with their Active Directory in their domain, and it can issue an encrypted SAML token with the claims that are appropriate for the relying party, in this case this app over in the Microsoft domain, that is required. That token can then be attached to the subsequent request as it travels back to the app,
and then the application can decompose that token, validate signatures according to the trust policy that has been formed with the STS. We pull out the claims information and make authorization and authentication decisions about granting or denying access to that client across the security bound. So you can see that we take all the things that work in a single security domain, and we're building infrastructure to allow that to happen across security domains. And it involves the addition of new protocols, new server technology, and new application infrastructure to allow people to, or applications to wield that protocol itself.
Thank you.